So I'm supposed to talk about hierarchy quasars in the SDSS. So we know the discovery of these luminous quasars at redshift higher than 6 is simply telling us that supermassive black holes with billion solar masses already exist at very high redshift, probably right at the end of cosmic dark ages. And I think they're telling us a lot about how hierarchy black hole form and how they're related to gas formation and the IGM evolution. For example, this plot, you've all seen it before, the evolution of quasar number density function redshift is teaching us something about the black hole accretion history in the universe, at least for those population traced by luminous quasars. And the local M-sigma relation is certainly telling us that quasars and galaxy formation are related. And this is one of the new high-resolution CO imaging we took with VLA of the highest redshift 6.4 quasar, in which we have actually both resolved the host galaxy spatially and kinematically, which teaches about the relation between black holes and the earliest galaxy evolution. And finally, I've seen a lot about the discussion of the Gompinson trough in the highest redshift quasars, which of course started this discussion of what it really means in terms of whether we have reached the end of reionization, and also about what the role of quasar played in this whole picture of reionization. I think we have been, actually been through a long way in terms of the quasar research in the last few decades. A number of new and very powerful surveys, probably from the 80s, the ATM survey, from the 90s, the digitized polymer sky survey, and more recently with the 2DF and the Sloan survey, and hopefully very, very soon in the future in things like QuAST or UKITS or the VISTA survey pushes even into near-infrared wavelengths. I think we're really entering a new era in the quasar research. In the sense that we're not only looking at quasars redshift beyond 4 or 5 or 6 or maybe later on 7, but also collecting large samples of these objects to study their statistical properties. Now there are more than 900 quasars been discovered redshift higher than 4, including 50 at redshift higher than 5, and 8 of them from the Sloan survey at redshift higher than 6. So, as you, most of you know, in the last 5 years, we have been carrying out this I-band dropout survey that are sensitive to basically redshift 6 quasars. And so far, we have looked for about 6,000 square degrees of Sloan imaging and discovered 16 quasars at redshift higher than 5.7. We're continuing this search and especially trying to push a little bit fainter. So maybe when everything is done with Sloan, we may be able to double or, if we're lucky, triple this total number of quasar redshift higher than 6, at redshift about 6, and really establish a very good sample to study the higher quasar population, the highest possible redshift. Okay, so here are the spectra of these 16 quasars at redshift about 6 also. As you can see, of course, in the highest redshift object, you see this almost total absorption coming from the Gompinson trough. And the other striking feature, as you can see, is the very strong emission lines, not only the lambda alpha, but strong lines coming from metals, indicating the early enrichment of this quasar environment as well. So today I'm going to present some of the more recent observational results of the follow-up of these quasars. I'll first say a little bit about the evolution of the early quasars, especially the evolution of the faint quasar at the high redshift. Then I'll give you some update of what the Gompinson test observations have shown recently, and what quasars' role in reionization would be. And then I'll talk about quasars themselves, about their metallicity and chemical enrichment, the black hole mass measurement, and finally, try to argue that by looking at the dust, gas, and star formation process in the high-redshift quasar, you may learn something about the growth of their host galaxies. A lot of the work has been done with a large number of collaborators, both inside and outside SDSS, to work on this multi-wavelength follow-up of these objects. I'll first start with this plot, which I think a lot of you have seen before. Just want to make a few obvious points about quasars themselves. This is, of course, a 17,000 quasar spectra coming from the SDSS. I just plot them on top of each other so you see the redshift at the emission line moves through the wavelengths. The first point I want to make is the y-axis. It's basically a function, it's a number count of quasars. So what you're seeing is, as we know for the last 15 years, that quasar population really grows very fast. At high redshift, it's basically when you go to higher redshift, it declines exponentially after you pass redshift 2 to 3, where the quasar number density peaks. So the quasar population evolves very strongly with redshift. To the contrast of that is the relatively smoothness and sort of the constant strength of the emission line tells you that the emission lines the metal lines especially, existed even at the highest redshift with very similar strength. So in contrast, the very strong evolution of quasar number density is an apparent lack of evolution of the quasar spectral energy distribution, in the sense that quasar environment probably doesn't even care very much about what happened with which redshift they live in. And third point I want to make is, really, you can see the very dark patch when you go to the highest redshift in the blue wavelines of the very strong absorption evolution when you go to highest, the IGM absorption when you go to the highest redshift. So you have seen this plot yesterday. This is the evolution of the number density of the most luminous quasars as a function of redshift. Actually, now we have 16 quasars at redshift, about 6. So you can actually put a quite tight constraint on the total number density here, which shows, again, the rapid decline continues all the way to redshift 6. The number density now is about a factor of 30 or 40 lower at redshift 6 than about redshift 2.5, where the density peaks, which clearly tells you this trend is tracing the initial growth of the supermassive black hole in the universe. But nevertheless, these quasars are, I think, quite amazing objects in the sense they are very bright. They are 1920s magnitude apparent. They are among the most luminous quasars you see at any redshift. Of course, they're extremely rare, but the black hole mass I'll see a little bit later is sort of 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10 solar masses, and they are like 5 to 6 sigma peaks in the density field already at high redshift, reside in very, very massive halos. How do you form these objects? Again, this object is really rare, so I do not think there's any problem in coming up with such massive halos in a very large volume that collapse at early times. But I do think we don't quite understand how do you continuously dump gas into the black hole and form such massive black hole short such short period of time. I think the detailed physical processes have to be worked out. They're clearly the rarest, most biased system in early times. And no matter how you want to form it, the initial assembly of the system, both the host galaxy and the black hole, would have to start very early on, probably well into the dark ages. So I would argue that these objects is providing us among the best examples of how the formation and evolution of supermassive black holes and galaxies are related. So these really are the brightest quasars. That's the thing that the Sloan main survey is sensitive to. We also don't know what is evolution of the faint quasars. In other words, how does the luminosity function evolve in terms of both the density and the shape? We know quite a bit about that low redshift. The 2DF luminosity function is known to be like quite well fit by a double power law with pure luminosity evolution, in the sense that the characteristic luminosity of the quasar population is declining towards lower redshift, as if the people have been calling the cosmic the downsizing of the black hole activity. The average size of the black hole activity is going down when you go to zero redshift. But we don't know whether that's true at high redshift or not. We don't know, especially whether the luminosity function shape evolves at high redshift or not. And I think that ties to a very important question about whether the X-ray and optical selected sample is treating the same population. This plot is still from the work of Lankovi and Amy Barger and collaborators, which show the evolution of the X-ray selected sample, which typically is at somewhat lower luminosity, from this optical select sample, which is at much higher luminosity. You see stronger evolution here. But whether this tells you something about the difference in the obscuration, therefore X-ray optically select sample is strongly biased, or whether it tells you something about the difference in the different luminosity quasars, is the way they're evolving, I think is not clear yet, and which really requires us to carry out faint quasar surveys at high redshift, which is hard, of course, because quasars are rare, so you have to cover a lot of area. This plot is, I think, what we know so far at redshift about 4.5, including all the data. We have been trying to go deeper at high redshift by using some of the deep imaging from Sloan. Basically, this is an area that Sloan has been scanning many, many times to build up a sample that you can typically go 2 to 3 magnitude deeper than the mean sample is enabling you. So this is the mean sample. Here is some preliminary result on the deep sample. And we're probably going to be able to push another magnitude fainter using some of the new spectrographs that we have at MMT. And these are some of the photometric select samples as well. So one thing you see here is, as we have actually heard quite a bit from Jennifer Scott's talk yesterday, this is flat. The high-resolution luminosity function seems to have somewhat different shapes then at low redshift is flatter than a low redshift. In other words, the luminosity function, not only the density of the of quasar population is involving with redshift, the shape is involving as well. I don't know what that quite tells you yet. I think by doing some modeling, you may be able to figure out whether this, what exactly causes this change, whether the shape change, whether it's something different in terms of how quasar phenomena is triggered at low and high redshift, basically at the rising and falling part of the density evolution. But one thing this does give you is a much better constraint on the total number of ionizing photons emitted by the quasar population, and whether or not these are the sources that are dominating the ionizing background at high redshift, whether or not they are the sources that cause reionization. Which a few years ago, as we know, Harold Mandel had already told us that they probably are not. Now with this new luminosity function, we actually did this calculation again using the SDSS luminosity function at redshift 6 connected to just extrapolating luminosity function shape that we observed at redshift 4 to 5. Basic conclusion is you probably cannot come up with enough photons. You just, with a range of the luminosity function shape, you just cannot come up with enough photons to at least keep the universe ionized by redshift 6 or even higher. This result, I think, is also consistent with what people have been using stacking X-ray images of Lemon-Bray galaxies in the ultra-deep field to see whether they can come up with enough photons. The same idea, they probably cannot, which means the very source of the ionized universe probably have to be something else, star formation, or at least not UE photons coming from high redshift quasars or AGNs. Which leads us to the next topic. I want to give you some update of what we think the evolution of the optical depths is doing with the Gompitan test. This is the evolution of Gompitan optical depths between redshift 4 and 6 using Lemon alpha transition alone, which we claim there probably is a hint, especially when you consider these are actually upper limit, a hint of things is taking off here in the sense that there is a transition and the slope of basic d tau dz is changing at redshift 6 also. But as we all know that Lemon alpha is relatively insensitive to high optical depths, so we want to find more sensitive tracers. So here's Lemon beta. Here I didn't assume anything about the clumpiness of IgM and so on. This is just based on Lemon beta alone. There's no involvement of Lemon alpha at all, except you have to correct for the foreground. And here I think what we see here is an even stronger trend. Again, a lot of these are probably upper limit. At redshift 6, even stronger trend of something is going on in terms of the slope of basically d tau dz. But we also see there's a lot of scatter when you go to this range when the optical depth become bigger. So what that is teaching you. When you combine those two, I think Ping showed this figure yesterday. When you combine those two again, you begin to see a hint of things is taking off and the slope is probably changing at those redshifts. But again, there's scatter, I think. So if you translate that into ionizing background, you see the strong trend of maybe things begin to dive to much lower, and you are seeing a rapid decline of ionizing background at redshift beyond 5.7. This is an older figure. But as I mentioned, there does seem to be significant line of sight to line of sight difference. These are, the two most striking examples, the 6.3 quasar and the 6.4 quasar, in which the 6.3 quasar, you see just no flux in this region, which we think is the Gompitan trough. And the 6.4 quasar, you see sort of stuff in the middle of it, although this stuff is not that bright in the sense that the continuum is right up there, but still, you see things. Some of the earlier work has speculated that these may be caused by some intervening galaxies or something like that. We now actually have a deep HST image using a narrowband filter centered exactly at this flux to see what is going on there. This is another filter centered at Lemon alpha. So what you see here is point source, in the sense that this flux is neither resolved nor displaced from a Lemon alpha emission of the quasar. It tells you this flux coming from the quasar itself. In other words, it's really an area in the Lemon beta transition that is more or less transparent, at least for this redshift, at this line of sight, at redshift 6, the ionization fractions is quite high. And the other thing it tells you that this quasar is not lens. So it's a very bright object, but apparently it's not, at least not notably imaged. So what does this different line of sight actually is telling you? Now we have five quasars, basically redshift higher than 6.1 or so. So the first order, we see strong absorption in all of these objects, both Lamb Alpha and Lamb Beta. And in the redshift range, immediately bluer of Lamb Alpha emission. But when you look at a different line of sight, and you define something like the last transmitting redshift, in the sense that where is the place, highest redshift, you can see flux after the proximity effect region from the quasar, this redshift ranged quite a bit from 5.85 to 6.15. We heard yesterday from Avi that if you interpret that as the ionization front is propagating, then you should expect a dispersion that is sort of similar to that range if you just do the back of the envelope calculation. I think to understand exactly what that means require, I think, big simulations that have a large volume that they can trace this different line of sight. I think we're going to hear a lot more of that from Nick Newton in the next talk, whether this means partial ionization, whether that means the radiation field is non-uniform, or whether this means that there's more gradual transition towards neutral. I think we are more or less reaching the end of what Gompidan talk can actually teach you, and we need to both compare with theory. As I argue here, in order to constrain the randomization network, we have to find more sensitive tests, in the sense that I think we all agree that whatever there's a sharp transition or not, the Gompidan test can only tell you that the neutral fraction, volume average neutral fraction, is about 0.1% at redshift 6 and or higher. And we don't really know whether it's here or there. And from tau to 10 or 15 or 20 to tau of 100,000 when the universe were neutral, there's a very long way to go. Whether or not the universe became 50% neutral at redshift 6.5 or 8.5 or maybe 15.5, or with what kind of scatter, I think the Gompidan talk is just not going to tell you much more than what you've already learned. You have to find with more powerful tests, such as we have heard, the size of H2 region. We'll probably hear more by using the possibility of having damping wind coming from the Gompidan 12, or using the existence of higher Lehmann alpha emitter and there in Quinlan West distribution to figure out what's going on, what is happening sort of either is here or beyond there. Okay, so that's about the Gompidan test. Now I want to spend the last 10 minutes talking about the quasars themselves. These again are the 16 quasars from the SDSS. I want to draw attention to the existence of these strong metal lines as you see here. Not only do we see Lyma alpha, we see very strong lines from carbon, oxygen, silicon, magnesium, iron. All these lines, especially these lines, are with the strains that is rather comparable to the strains of lines in much lower redshift quasars, which is sort of illustrated in this figure, the redshift 6 quasar composite compared to a much lower redshift composite. In both the spectral shape and the strains of emission lines, they are very, very comparable. We have actually can make an even stronger statement that when we look at even other wavelengths, look at X-ray, look at radio, the spectral energy distribution of quasar redshift 6 for the same luminosity compared to redshift 2 or redshift 3, they're just not very, very little evolution. Tells us that there must be very rapid chemical enrichment in the quasar vicinity, and the high-pressure quasar environment have to mature very early on. We heard yesterday about using these observations to actually constrain the chemical enrichment and chemical evolution in these high-pressure objects, in the sense that the strong emission line, existence of the strong emission line, and the strength and the ratio of these lines are consistent with the environment of quasars of supersolar metallicity. Some of the more diagnostic lines teaching us that, for example, nitrogen teaching us that maybe there are multiple generations of star formation from quite chemical rich population. The iron's contribution, some of them may even come from population 3 stars. One thing that I'm not quite sure what the answer is these are emission line regions. These are stuff that is very, very close to the central engine of quasar. These are probably the most extreme environment you can imagine at high redshift. So how can you generalize the result you learn from here to sort of the host galaxy or the general chemical evolution of the universe at high redshift is not quite clear yet, I think. But one of the interesting work that I think Rafael talked about yesterday, which I just want to emphasize here again, is very interesting about the possibility of the existence of supernova dust, or at least extinction consistent with having supernova dust produced us in this low ionization BL quasar redshift 6. This is actually one of the first evidence I see that high quasar redshift 6 looked somewhat different from low redshift quasars finally. I think the implication is actually quite important in the sense that if dust really is different at those high redshift objects, then it will affect our interpretation of the AGN models at high redshift, how the dust emission coming out from AGNs, and especially when you try to interpret the submillimeter observation connection with star formation rate estimate and to make extinction correction for both high redshift quasars and high redshift galaxies. If dust is produced in different way at high redshift, all these things you have to think a little bit harder about. I think one benefit of knowing that dust aside, the photoionization structures of high redshift quasars look extremely similar from the photoionization structures of low redshift quasars, telling you that at least for how the central engine worked or how the structure of the emission line region worked or the accretion disk worked, there's very little change from redshift 0 to redshift 6. Quasar doesn't care which redshift they're living in. And that tells you that the things that we learn about quasar, or especially in terms of the black hole mass measurement at redshift 0 or low redshift, are probably still valid, both in terms of how you do it and in terms of the overall calibration, are probably still valid at high redshift. This, I think, I would argue this gives us still the only possible way of measuring black hole mass at redshift 6. It's very hard to do it with any other ways. And here, you're having a, although it's still with quite sizable error bar, a way that you can measure it, and you can measure it quite easily by just measuring the line width of quasar emission line regions and use your capital slow to, and try to estimate the size of the emission line region and use your capital slow to get the black hole mass. And you see here is a collection of black hole mass of different redshift. First is that these quasars with this kind of line width measurement of black hole mass have half black hole mass of billions, sometimes even 10 billion solar masses. So billion solar masses is really growing very, very early on. And you can think about how you can grow. If you're just wanting to grow Eddington, for some of these objects, simply do not have enough time. We certainly can come up with ways of growing much faster than Eddington, but again, the simple point I want to make is that you just don't have enough time here. You have to basically grow them continuously. So which raises the question that whether or not you can really grow black holes as fast as you can, whether or not you can grow an actually large black hole at high redshifts. Yes, this is 10% efficiency. I think they assume 10% efficiency with some seed black hole mass of 1,000 or 100. So the question, I think the other interesting question is whether or not you can grow black holes really very, very fast. This is a black hole mass measurement coming from these emission line measures across the whole redshift range. I think something that I suspect is I simply do not see black holes with mass exceeding several times 10 to 10 solar masses, actually at any redshift that Sloan is sensitive to. Although I do think we actually cover enough volume, maybe we should begin to see some of these objects. I'm not quite sure what that quite means yet, but I think one thing that worth of considering is whether or not there may be an average envelope of black hole mass at very high end, what that implies about how fast quasars or black holes can create. And I think the interesting question, the contest is whether how the black hole accretion history is really tracing the host galaxy assembly history by looking at the black hole mass distribution of a large sample of quasars at high redshift. Which leads us to the last thing I want to talk about is the possibility of looking at the environment in the host galaxy of very high redshift quasars. This is a new very deep VLT imaging that we have, the work led by Laura Quandarici. We have, I think, something like a little over 50 hours. It's an I, D, and J band in this redshift 6.3 quasar region. If you cannot find the quasar, it's this object with this weird green color. This is the quasar itself. We looked at about 38 square arc minutes around the quasar, down to a Z-band limiting magnitude about 26, and found 19 dropout candidates, sort of I-band dropout candidates with colors consistent with the objects, the redshift 6 also, which is quite a bit higher in terms of their surface density than those people had found from, say, look at Goosefield, look at UDF. Although we don't know any of them are real or not, whether redshift is yet, it's certainly suggestive that this quasar is living in some kind of environment which much higher density. Until we get spectroscopic follow-up observations, it's hard to say what the overdensity is, but I think that's quite suggestive. The other thing is when you have 15 hours on VLT, you actually reach quite faint in J-band. And one thing we try to do is to try to subtract out the PSF and see whether we see any sort of FUD or whatever stuff around it. If you think about it, these redshift 6 quasars got to be extremely young, which means if you just assume the typical Magorian kind of relation, their host galaxy is very bright because the stellar age cannot be older than a few hundred million years, basically. And we basically cannot detect any evidence of host galaxy down to probably magnitude of 21 or 22, which again is dependent on the stellar age you assume, but safely place the luminosity of the host galaxy below the redshift zero Magorian kind of relation. This is the first indication that that the black hole may actually outgrow the bulge in the sense that the black hole is growing faster. But I would argue this is a hard way of doing this stuff because you're fighting with this very bright quasar in the middle, and I'm not sure whether I'll ever believe PSF subtraction of that level when you try to study the host galaxy. The much better way is to look at the wavelength that the quasar host galaxy is not, the quasar itself is not dominating, namely by looking at longer wavelengths, sub-millimeter radio wavelengths, where at least for the radio quiet quasars, you know that most of the radiation is coming from the dust emission coming in the host galaxy. So actually, people have been carrying a large sample of observation, a large sample of these quasars at high redshift. And the bottom line is, when you look at about 1 millimeter observed wavelengths, so observation mostly done by ARM and SCUBA, about 40% or one-third of them are detected at 1 millijansky level. This is observed frame, which gives you a very high far infrared luminosity, comparable to, I think, one of these curves is up to 20. Yeah, these two curves that indicate things like ARP220. So this has a lot of dust in it, and transferred into a thermal dust mass of something like 10 to 9 solar masses. And if you're just using the local submillimeter to star formation conversion, that gives you a very high star formation rate of several hundred, sometimes exceeding 1,000 solar masses per year by looking at a strong thermal dust emission. Of course, making a assumption, which I'm not quite sure is completely justified, that all the dust heating coming from the starburst. But nevertheless, this strong dust emission does suggest is suggestive that these quasars are living in very intensive star formation environment. The most striking example of this kind of work is actually the highest redshift quasar, this redshift 6.4 quasar, in which we have both detected this object in dust emission, in a continuum emission, as a very strong iron source, this is from the dust, indicating a similar dust mass, and in CO line emission, actually in a number of different transitions, indicating a very large H2 mass of 10 to 10 solar mass as well. More recently, work led by Fabian Water, we have obtained a very high resolution VLA map on the CO3-2 transition. The physical size of the beam is like 1 kiloparsec, physical redshift 6. And what you can see here is this object is actually resolved. This is the host galaxy, the CO from the host galaxy is actually resolved to two different peaks, and the whole size of the object is on the order of 2 kiloparsecs. I don't know what you make of the two different peaks, whether it's just a strong high surface mind region sticking out, or whether it's some kind of disk structure, it's not clear. But clearly this object is spatially resolved. I think this is the first example of a redshift 6 quasar host galaxy being spatially resolved. It's also kinematically resolved in the sense that you look at the different channel maps, the center of the object shifts, and the total line width from CO is like 280 kilometers per second. If you combine those two numbers, the size of the object and the line width, you get a dynamical mass of the order of 10 to the 10 solar masses within 2 kiloparsec. This is not a lot of mass, given the size of the black hole. The black hole's mass of this object is something like 3 times 10 to the 9 solar masses. And if you extrapolate using any version of the M-sigma relation, for the total bulge mass, you're going to get a lot bigger than 10 to the 10 to 10 to the 11 solar masses. Again, this is only one object, it's maybe a weird object, but it does seem suggestive that at least for this object, the formation or the total the assembly of the black hole probably precede the total complete galaxy assembly of the host galaxies. This is probably a galaxy still forming with a very, very massive black hole in the middle. Okay, so now reach the conclusion. So I've covered a few things about the observation of high-resolution quasars. First, they evolve very strongly at high redshift, but the high-resolution luminosity function seems to be flat. About reionization, we think that neutral fraction is rising quite rapidly when you go beyond redshift 5.7. We don't know how rapid this is or how long it takes to reach reionization, of course. And I want to point out it is with considerable scatter. And I think this is safe to say that UV photons coming from quasars is not enough to keep the universe ionized, the redshift lower than 6. From the quasars themselves, the lack of spectral evolution in quasars tells us that quasar environment matured very early on with really rapid chemical enrichment. The black hole mass at high redshift is probably still valid, reliable, which tells us that black hole mass of 10 to the 10, approaching 10 to the 10 exists at redshift 6. But maybe, or maybe not, there's an upper limit. And finally, I argue that the best way of looking at host galaxies of high-redshift quasars is to go to longer wavelengths. Think that this kind of stuff, ELMA, is going to enable to do really very, very well. And so far, the observation is consistent with these site of very high star formation rate. And by looking at the spatially resolved observation of the redshift 6, a redshift 6.4 host galaxy, we see evidence that suggesting the black hole growth is starting before or the full assembly of the host galaxy. I'll stop here.
Okay, questions for the speaker?
Okay. You showed the 16 spectra, the quasars, the redshift greater than 5.7. The edge of the Lyman alpha lines did not, to me, appear to be steep in most cases.
And we had a long discussion about that yesterday with Abby. Well, can we see that again, please?
Sure.
See?
Well, it's hard to say, but this stretch, this deliberate stretch in that way, I think.
Well, I mean, the second to bottom one has a ledge
one.
At 10.
Oh, these are, yeah, I think this is probably, Abby will be happy with it, because these are objects before round, certainly after, these are the objects certainly where the universe is completely on that. We don't know what happened there, but for these objects, I think Abby would predict these objects have bigger H2 regions than at higher redshift. Maybe Abby comment on that.
The point is there is some mean redshift at which Lyman alpha transmission was made possible in the intergalactic medium, and there is a large scatter around that of the order of 0.1 to 0.2. And what you see here is the scatter among different lines of sight. I mean, these are rare objects, they are not correlated at all. So what you're looking at is the scatter in the time at which the IGM allowed transmission of Lyman alpha photons, and you don't expect them all to line up in terms of the transmission. But could I ask a question that is one point about what you've said has to do with the relative size of the black hole and the host galaxy. And a point that was missed by some observers in the literature is as follows. If you assume that the black hole correlates with velocity dispersion, not with the bulge mass, uh-huh. but with the bulge velocity dispersion, then the velocity dispersion itself has a redshift dependence, not just a mass dependence.
Yes.
So for a halo of a given mass, the velocity dispersion should grow with increasing redshift. That's 1 plus z to the 1/2. And then the black hole goes like velocity dispersion to the 4th or to the 5th. You would expect the black hole mass relative to the stellar mass to go up as you go to higher redshifts because of that.
So you would predict that falling under the local M sigma.
So you would expect that the black hole mass fraction would be larger relative to the stars as you go to higher redshifts. There was some early evidence for that from gravitational lensing in the class survey.
Okay.
So Richard and then Len and then Simon. Unless it's
Just a comment on the iron abundance results that you obtained. There's recent results from Hubble surveys of type 1As, which have gotten an empirical age of 2 to 4 gigayears mm-hmm. before the type 1s explode.
Yeah.
There's clearly not 2 to 4 gigayears available for the production.
So it's clearly coming from type 2 or
type
some
2s.
Even more exotic sources.
And you know, as Stan Woosley will tell you, that's a very interesting constraint on the amount of metals that one can produce from type 2s. So this is, I think, a very interesting result. And that was also indicated from XMM spectra of some Baal quasars at redshifts of 3 that indicate very high iron metallicity. So I think we have to look at different modes of metal creation in the early universe, as indicated by these data.
I just wanted to make a brief comment on the X-ray. AGM determination. There's actually almost a perfect, I think Richard will talk about this, but there's almost a perfect correlation between the optically detected broadline AGN and the X-ray selected samples. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the X-ray, I mean, at lower redshift, say Z less than 4, there's almost a perfect agreement between the X-ray luminosity function and the broadline optical line function.
So
I think this just reinforces your conclusion, because in fact, the X-ray results are consistent with the shallow determination.
So I think that means that different luminosity quasars peak at different, or AGNs peak at different time, and they grow at different rate.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And low luminosity ones peak around z equals 1, sort of intermediate at 2 or 3.
So when we get our faint quasar luminosity function, we'll see that on the optical side as well, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'd like to explore a bit more how accurate you think the masses are, since I think this could be a critical issue. So when you say the high redshift masses are reliable, I guess you mean that the emission line properties look similar to low redshift quasars, and so the relation between emission line width and mass is presumably the same as for low redshift
quasars.
They're
as reliable as low redshift, which is factor of 3 to 5-ish. So,
but then, of course, there's the question of how good the calibration of the line width to mass relation is, even for the low redshift quasars,
so
because it's not directly measured.
That's give you a factor of 3 to 5, I think. That's where, I mean, the calibration is done by looking at the black hole mass measured from line width to black hole mass measured from reverberation mapping, and this give a factor of 3.
That's true, and then there's also the uncertainty in the reverberation mapping, which
is not
small.
Yeah, so that's probably giving another factor of 3. So I think we're talking about factor of, I would believe it's a factor of 5 so far, but I think with hard work, you may be able to get a little bit better in the future. Yes, the Eddington ratio gives you the same value. Again, the scatter is big. You can actually, with that, you can calculate how the Eddington ratio of these quasars, and they're scattered all over the place with very few of them bigger than 1, of course, which actually gives you some other confidence about this measurement is sort of reasonable because you don't see a lot of quasars at super Eddington.
I also had a comment on what Avi said. I think at low redshift, there's quite a good relation between black hole mass and bulge velocity dispersion, but I don't know of any observationally demonstrated relationship between black hole mass and halo asymptotic velocity, which is the thing which you expect to change with redshift. Mm-hmm. That's just assumed.
I'd like to mention some work that, with any luck, will be posted on AstroPH next week, where my student Pascal Paskos and I analyzed the transmission of the IGM immediately after reionization. And we did this within the context of homogeneous reionization, using a UV background supplied by Hart and Madow, included a galactic component. And what we find, well, what this paper does is introduce a whole variety of statistical measures for transmission, not just the optical depth, but the variance, the skewness, and the kurtosis. And what we find is even in a homogeneous scenario, there is a large variance in the line of sight to line of sight optical depth as you approach the tail of reionization. And in order to really figure out when reionization occurred, we show that you need many lines of sight to quasars at redshifts.
How many quasars do you want?
100.
Okay.
I hadn't planned to present that here, but I'm going to your meeting in Tucson, and based on your work, I think I'll roll that out.
Okay. Great.
The emission lines don't change. Have you measured that quantitatively quantitatively, and can you compare that back to what would a change look like? Because the quasar emission line generation is quite a complex process, and it's not obvious to me that changes in the quasars physically would manifest in the emission lines looking that different.
So we don't have enough quasars, I think, a redshift 6 to say that quantitatively yet, except look at the composite, it looks the same. I mean, you can quantify that. But a lower redshift, basically, we have enough quasar chop in the different bins and look and compare at least the UV spectrum of these objects, you observe basically the same kind of bottoming effect, different redshift. So that's an indication that things really didn't change very much. The emission line, the relation between the emission line and continuum sort of is still roughly working the same way. But I don't think we have anything published about actually parallelize,
like line widths look the same, and line edge symmetry.
I'm not aware of any published result of quantify that statement, except just by looking all sort of things plot against each other, they look the same.
So it could still be the case they're quite different from low Z quasars. It's just emission lines, not a great way to tell what they're like.
Yeah, it says that for formalization, it's not telling you. I mean, it's just telling you what's going. The photoionization structure shouldn't change very much with redshift anyway. And then abundance is probably pretty constant. It just tells you the abundance doesn't change very much. And these line ratios has sensitivity on abundance.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. There's time for one more quick question. Okay. Well, then let's thank Xiaoyi.
Thank you.